Papaji,
when he was describing how instead of you shouldn't have desires, and he said, no, you have to have that one desire, you know? I love that. That's like samatha. It's like, desires are not bad. They're only bad because you're confused. We only have one desire. Just one.
Welcome to Buddha at the Gas Pump. My name is Rick Archer. Buddha at the Gas Pump is an ongoing series of conversations with spiritually awakening people. I've done 730-something of them now. If this is new to you and you'd like to check out previous ones, please go to batgap.com, B-A-T-G-A-P, and check under the past interviews menu where you'll see all the old ones, so previous ones organized in a variety of ways. And there's also some other cool stuff there, like an AI spiritual chat bot and other things. This program is made possible through the support of appreciative listeners and viewers. So if you appreciate it and would like to help support it, there are PayPal buttons on every page of the website. And there's also a page which explains other things. Some people don't like to use PayPal. They send us a check or whatever. My guest today is Ricard Perez. He is living in Berlin, Germany. He's a meditation coach and a musician whose work bridges ancient traditions with fresh, practical insight. What kind of musician are you, Ricard?
The good ones.
I mean, what do you play?
I play a little bit of everything.
Drums, guitar, horns.
Exactly.
All those things. Wow.
Piano.
Piano. Wow, you're multi-talented. Is that like your main profession, being
yes,
a musician?
Yeah, that's what I spent my whole life with until recently. So it's not that this thing of becoming a meditation coach is very much of a spontaneous thing happening in the last months, 18
okay.
months or something like that.
So we'll talk about that. And, you know, you have an eclectic appreciation of a variety of paths and traditions. Buddhism, Advaita Vedanta, A Course in Miracles, and other things. You have been a friend and student of Shinzen Young, whom I've interviewed a couple of times. And you emphasize meditation as a dynamic balance of clarity and release with simple methods for direct entering silence. I read your book, A Gap to Eternity. Rather, I should say I converted it to audio and listened to it. And I liked it a lot. And two main points jumped out at me, which we're going to discuss. One is latency and the other is fractals. And we'll have to go into an explanation of what both of those things are. You like the connection of science with spirituality and science and creativity, which I very much like also, I think for various reasons we'll also discuss. You say that your love of music, art, and ecstatic expression bring a celebratory dimension to the path of awakening. That's good. I like the idea of a celebratory path to awakening instead of an overly serious, morose one. So what got you started on the spiritual path? Have you been meditating for a long, long time? What first attracted you to it?
I was worrying that you will ask me that question. It's difficult to answer. Well, the first moment that I recall something special, especially what I mean, something that felt something I couldn't talk to anyone or understand what it was, it happened with music. That's when I became a musician. Uh-huh. I recently actually hear somewhere that when people have this first stage of arising and passing, and this greater also of whatever is the activity they're involved in becomes a very important thing in their life. That seems to be what happened to me when I was 9. I remember a Saturday morning, I was just casually listening to the radio and the people, there were kids in the pool and a beautiful summer sun coming in. And there was just this great rock song just getting in with drums and dun, 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 dun. And I just felt like a strong sense of energy through my body. And I don't know, I was like all over the place. Clearly see something happened there because since then I've been kind of obsessed with music, like, many of you, I think you are a musician too, right?
I was a drummer.
You were a drummer. Oh, cool. Best friend of a musician. And that's a musician's joke. There's nothing wrong with it.
I never heard it before, but I get it.
Anyway, so yeah, that kind of changed a little the curse. I felt a little bit awkward about everything. And I went down into experiences, drugs, mysticism, books, like, I don't know, how do you call that in English? John Salvatore. Oh my God.
St. John of the Cross? What are you talking about?
Somebody? Oh my God. It's going to, the seagull.
Oh, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Exactly. Richard Bach.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. So that was something also, The Man in Search for Meaning. Yeah. There were some books like Casually Read and Castaneda that I read during my teenage
years.
That sort of like, I said, oh my God, this is it. There is something about that. And from then on, yeah, well, the story goes on.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I'd say that for me, music was also kind of an initial impetus to interest in spirituality. I mean, you know, it was summer of 67, we're doing drugs. The Beatles came out with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and you're lying there on the floor between two big speakers high on something or other. And, you know, I would have these profound, you know, expansive experiences, and they're talking about spiritual stuff in their lyrics and everything. And then they learned to meditate, and that became a big sort of phenomenon that everybody heard about what they were doing. So it was a springboard, you know.
Was that your connection to TM?
Yeah. Yeah. Because they went to India to study with the Maharshi, who was the founder of TM, and everybody heard about it. And so when I finally decided I should stop taking drugs and learn to meditate, that was the kind of meditation I figured, oh, I might as well do that. That's what the Beatles did. And, and it was one of the only things around in those days. But music can really, I mean, probably almost everyone listening to this has experienced that music can change your consciousness. You know, you get into an altered state when you're listening to some kinds of music. That's why kirtans are very popular. Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I think many people, music is obviously a great entertainer, let's say. It helps connect people at every level. But what I didn't really understood until way, way later is that, and it's related to the book, because I didn't know this. I was just like diving in all this stuff all my life. I just felt the most casual thing. But it seems that when you really give yourself to the music, let's say, if you listen clearly to every detail of it, you really go into something that is more like a meditation rather than just the pleasure of playing a music and a song and remember, oh, that last summer, oh, I like that song. You know, that's one level, certainly.
Yeah.
There are deeper and deeper and deeper levels of music. And I think that's what many of us, I would say even accidentally some way, just get pulled into deeper experiences.
Yeah. And when you're actually playing the music and not just listening, and you're playing with a band, it creates a sort of a coherence in your brain, at least I experienced, where if you've been playing a little while, you just are again in a different state. And then you're kind of also in a different state with a group of other people. Everybody's coming into a kind of collective coherence with each other.
Yeah, that's actually my relationship with meditation grows out of that experiences. So meditation for me has been the way of integrating that, but many times I've been always surprised, like, oh, so meditation is music without music.
Yeah.
You know, it is, they just figure out all these patterns of your consciousness behind what is behind the experience of music. In the case of many of us, they just kind of like were able to put it out and were able to sustain that connection, not beyond the music itself. So you can enjoy it 24/7 rather than just when you play music.
Yeah, that's an important point. Not only with regard to music, but with regard to meditation, it's not just an experience here, an experience there. It's more a matter of culturing something that abides continuously without you having to even think about it. It's just there, like breathing.
Yeah, one of Sinsen's teachers said that if you go out of it, it wasn't a true shamadhi.
Mm-hmm.
I always say, well, that's brilliant. This one of these, meaning that sometimes you go through stages and through experiences and through stuff like that. But he was referring to that when you really hit something that is more transcendental, to use a word, more real, that's not something you come back from it. It's just like real samadhi is a samadhi that stays.
So, yeah. Well, there are terms in this in the tradition that has given us the word samadhi. And some samadhis by definition are temporary and intermittent. But then, you know, what is it? Nirvikalpa samadhi is the permanent one, which just never goes.
Yeah, in this context, this was a Zen teacher.
A Zen teacher. Okay.
Yeah,
they use the word samadhi also. It's true.
I mean, it's a bit not so specific, like in more yoga or vaita samadhis. It was more like, you know, when you go, for example, in Zen, you go into these kind of states of deep concentration, a certain kind of temporary samadhi that you, right. that you reach. And the teacher was make a distinction. You get out of it, then it wasn't so real some way.
Yeah. I think the way I would put a fine point on that is that even the temporary ones are, going to be less clear and deep than a sort of final one that one might have, of which you never lose once you have it. So in other words, there's always going to be some fog, some lack of clarity to some subtle degree in these temporary samadhis. But then finally, there's a time when the fog totally clears. And then, you know, it's there all the time, waking, dreaming, and sleeping.
Yeah, I think this leads a little bit to a very interesting point. I was looking forward to discuss with you because I really would like to pick your brain on this. Because you were mentioning before this progressive versus direct.
Yeah, we were talking about that before we started recording.
And I found this as really interesting. I think we are falling into that conversation a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think when for example, Sinser's teacher was saying that was pejorative to the sense that temporary samadhis are not useful or are not important. I don't think he got in like, but meaning that there is some kind of, something you can contact that suddenly it changes the perception of everything. And as we were discussing, it's not that it will never finish, it's that it never really started even. It seems that it has been always there. We just didn't notice it. And I think that's the permanent gold mine of something that can help us flow through all the comings and goings with a nice continuum, let's say.
Yeah. There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that says the unreal has no being, the real never ceases to be. And, you know, with regarding our experience of that, obviously it's something that initially for most people is going to be intermittent and partial and perhaps unclear. But that's the whole idea of spiritual practice, is that it becomes more and more clear. And I could give you an analogy. Let's say in India, the way they used to dye cloth, and maybe they still do out in the villages, is they would take a white cloth and dip it in some colored dye, and then they would put it and bleach it in the sun for a few hours until it dried out and it was bleached as much as it was going to be. And then they would dip it in the dye again and then bleach it in the sun again. And they'd go back and forth until eventually it wouldn't bleach, and even if you left it in the bright sunlight. So that's a good analogy for what certain types of spiritual practice can be, where, you know, you
it will bleach? What it means that it was?
Well, bleaching means it loses its color when it's sitting in the bright sun, you know, as things do if they fade if they're in the sun.
Yeah.
But eventually, if you repeat this process enough, the cloth won't fade.
Yeah.
Even if it's in the bright sun. So like that, spiritual practice, you don't do it 24 hours a day. You'd starve to death if you were just sitting with your eyes closed all day. But you dip in, you engage in activity, you dip in again, you engage in activity. There are neurophysiological changes which take place, which that, and on subtle levels, I'm sure, with the subtle body and everything, a culturing or a refinement takes place, which ultimately results in a permanent abiding state of pure awareness.
Yeah. 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 That learning by contrast and how that contrast creates, you know, just brings me to my mind Vipassana, in the sense of all this discerning between or Vaitavedanta, what is real and what is not real, and how you go back and forth between things. And let's say you sit to meditate and it's relatively easy. I mean, easy if you spend some time with it to feel how you can calm your body, how calm your metabolism, how your mind calms. And then you have a certain sense of a certain perspective where you can intuitively feel something real behind your personal. And then you go into life and you get engaged again. And the point is how to get to feel it. That thing that you were, let's say, noticing in the meditation, because the meditation created this special environment that make it easier to notice. The mastery, I think, becomes when you really integrate it in all your life, and every moment you feel that. Even when your body moves and your mouth talks, there's still this sense of, something that, emptiness, maybe, is that the first word that comes to my mind, in the sense of something that is not necessarily based on perceptions. You cannot talk about it. You cannot remember it. It's just there.
Emptiness, fullness, same thing.
Yeah.
And it's there, like I think you're saying this, it's there without you having to remind yourself all day. It's like if you although I think it's good to sort of have a certain quality of vigilance. Carlos Castaneda's teacher talked about this. He said a warrior has time only for his impeccability. In other words, you have to sort of be on your toes and not be careless, thoughtless, and so on. Yeah. But on the other hand, sort of being on your, you don't hold on to pure awareness by trying to remember it all day any more than you remain clean by remembering the shower you took this morning.
I like, you know, mindfulness is a kind of a trendy word nowadays. And always to me, what it struck me, like what it really made me realize, okay, that's what that word means. It's the original word, as you, probably everybody knows, is sati. And one of the meanings is remembrance. Mm-hmm. When I hear that, I say, yeah, obviously that what he was. So whenever I hear some speeches of the Buddha or something talking about mindfulness or sati, it was just, I saying, yeah, I know what you're remembering. I know what remember means. It's not remembering like you're recollecting a memory. It's just you're landing in the here and now. You're remembering that you are. I mean, I don't know if I'm going a bit too deep too soon.
No, it's okay. And it kind of relates to your latency point, which we're going to get into. And there's another thing towards the very end of the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna says to Krishna, I remember my true nature now, you know, something like that. And usually we think of remembrance as being, oh, I remember what I did in high school, you know, or I remember my first date, or I remember I used to play in a band. But that's a different sense of the word. This is not like remembering something in the past. It's more like a recognition of what it has always been here, as you were saying a few minutes ago.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So we're talking about remembrance and, abiding awakening. And one of the main themes of the first part of your book was latency. And I'd never heard that word used in the way you were using it. And I found it very interesting. And I had some thoughts about it as I was listening to your book. So if you want, why don't you start talking about that right now? Explain what you mean by it and why you consider it important.
Yeah. Well, the story comes that I'm actually not a fan of science. I'm just saying this because it was never in my scope of, I like it like everyone else, you know, I find it super interesting, but it was more in the artistic side where you're not so meticulous on the reason for this book and all these terms and trying to explain. It's not like something that came out naturally to me. It's the cultural shock to meet Shinzen, because
you're referring to Shinzen Young here. Yes.
Yeah. For those of you who may not know him, he's basically a scientist in a way. He really likes science. He knows very well about science, and he tries to even use language like scientists, very, very, very impeccable, very precise. So when I got to start talking to him, I find, okay, we have a problem. I don't know how to, I'm just throw concepts lightly, carelessly all the time. And so start thinking, okay, how can I start connecting with this bright, specific mind? And I say, okay, I start noticing some of his exercises. For those of you who don't know, he works in a kind of like a Vipassana style where you're just noticing what's happening. For example, suddenly you hear something and you say, hear. You feel something, you say, feel. So you're labeling.
Do you really? I mean, if I hear a bird singing, do I say, hear? Or do I just experience the bird?
Sorry, I'm just talking about the technique Shinzen is promoting most. Unified mindfulness. He has this fantastic way he has synthesized. I said this for anyone interested on that. Is really, I think he did an incredible job in synthesizing all these traditions into something accessible for anyone. Nevertheless, I'm just trying to explain where all this comes from, that making this process of noticing things, which doesn't imply that you have to say the word. You say the word in the beginning, just you label the experience, but later on, you just kind of like picture, not picturing, but kind of noticing.
Recognize.
So as he put me into this kind of pressure, and I was like going through this deep process with his techniques, when I started talking to him, I started realizing a frustrating sensation. And I didn't know that I was starting noticing that there was a delay. Mm-hmm. Consciousness had a delay. It was like shocking to me to feel that sometimes there was like a sensory contact. And it took a few milliseconds for me consciously understand and, let's say, have a reaction to that. Let's say if it's a gust of wind in your skin or anything, whatever it is, it took time to build that reaction. And I was just like all the time feeling that I was behind the experience. I couldn't be here and now, really. It just felt like everything was just pointing towards like I'm just full of processing, interpreting device of my personal life. And I was just became extremely curious with that. And as we discussed before, I'm a musician, so I got to be very sensitive to delays. Delays, I say, for those of you who don't know, latency is a technical word for a certain delay. So you put something in a system and it takes some time to get out of it. And so that's the latency. So for example, now if I'm talking, there will be a difference between my mouth moving and the words coming to everybody listening to this. There will be a gap. That will be latency.
I mean, right now people are listening to the live stream of this, and what they're hearing is what we said like 5 seconds ago. It takes that a little while for it to come on the live stream.
That is too. But I was just trying to say something that people could relate to, not to make it too scientific, in the sense that if people, you may think, oh, I don't notice that. I don't notice that delay between my experience and me and so on. So I was trying to explain, actually, if you really pay attention, everybody's noticing. Because, for example, now in this, for some reason, the audio of and the video of this becomes a bit mismatched, even in just a few milliseconds. People can pinpoint, seems that there is lip syncing or something like that. It seems like something weird about it. So that's kind of the experience that I had with my direct experience. I was feeling all the time, oh my God, what's happening? I'm always behind. I'm always like, I can never catch the moment right as it is. So that's why my entry point of the conversation with Simpson. And we started. So I find, okay, that's something I can talk that I know very well. And it's really bugging me, my experience of meditation. And I wanted to hear, and he explained me, first thing, he threw back at me that actually my music training had a lot to do with me noticing that things. Many people may not have noticed that specific aspect. Like I said, it will go into your brain. We will see there are certain areas that are more trained for that. That's why you notice that. And we start discussing about what this latency means. What is, how it affects your experience. The fact that you notice something right as it's happening on real time, or if you're noticing a little gap and what's happening in this gap. So the more, since it was kind of guiding me, it wasn't really telling me things, it was just like helping me to understand what I was saying. What happened, or the first part of the book is all about what happens when you open up and these little milliseconds that apparently seems to be something we don't notice. And yet that's where all our suffering is taking place. We just don't notice because it kind of happens relatively quickly. But if you, for example, when people have the expression of being here and now, like you just made, you know, a retreat, or you made a meditation, or you just leave it, you were about to die just a few moments ago, and suddenly just kind of everything feels so real. You're not processing. You're not thinking about things you normally think. This kind of intimacy with the moment as it happens, that will be like a low latency. And on the contrary, someone who's, you know, this is something that happens to all of us, that sometimes you get angry at something, someone, but you just even notice that you're angry like long before. You were so infused in this reaction to it that you didn't even notice that you were reacting like that. You know, that I don't know if this is a clear example, but there is the more we have all these thoughts where we think and we talk, oh yeah, because that shouldn't have happened. And the more we create like a gap between how we experience life and how life is actually happening.
Yeah. Let me tell you some thoughts about what you just, that I have about what you just said and what I was thinking as I was listening to your book. My understanding, which kind of again corresponds with the Vedic tradition, is that there are different levels of thought, from subtle to gross, you could say. And they even have names for that in Sanskrit. The gross spoken word, the gross thought word, subtle impulse of thought even before it gets any kind of verbal quality to it, and then something that's beyond all those, just sort of the silent absolute field. And you could use an analogy to understand this, which is like, let's say in a pond or an ocean, bubbles come up from the bottom and they bubble up and they get larger as they come up and they finally burst on the surface of the water. And the average person doesn't see the bubble until it bursts on the surface. But that's actually some time since it left the bottom of the ocean. So a diver, you know, goes down and he can see the bubbles at earlier stages of their emergence to the surface. And he can even go to the very bottom and watch as the bubble comes out right from the mud or whatever. from the bottom of the ocean. So with thoughts, impulses come from a deep level of the mind of which we're generally unaware. And they bubble up until eventually they burst on the surface as a conscious thought. But when you do certain types of spiritual practice, you can kind of like trace the thought back to its source. You can kind of ride the bubbles down, so to speak, and then arrive at the source from which they arose. And you can kind of end up residing in a place that's prior to the emergence of thought. If that becomes kind of established, then you catch thoughts spontaneously when they first emerge. And you therefore can have not sort of a manipulative kind of control, but a discriminative kind of control, where you can just more easily choose to ignore a thought, like which otherwise might come out as a burst of anger in the average person. You can just sort of say, nope, I'm not going to express that. I'm just going to check it. And it dissipates like just a ball of sawdust disintegrating in your hand. You can reside at a level at which I talk to people who describe this beautifully, who you can reside at a level at which thoughts have not even taken on a verbal quality. They're just kind of like subtle impulses that don't have English or Spanish or German words associated with them yet. And you can reside on that. It's a deep intuitive level of experiencing. And one can live that from there and act from there. And it results in a whole different quality. And so the latency is very short. Because, you know, there's not this delay between the emergence of the thought and the point at which you finally become aware of it. You're aware even before the thought emerges, and you're aware as it emerges. And so there's little or no latency.
Exactly. Exactly. It matches perfectly. Good. Yeah. As you're saying, this is not the new discovery.
Right.
Hopefully it's something that helps people reflect in their experience in a slightly different way and notice this effect that you're describing is well known, actually.
But you're the first person I've ever heard talk about it, really. I mean, I was aware of the concepts and there's some Vedic literature about it, but you're the first spiritual teacher person that I've ever heard really use the word latency.
Yeah, latency, as I said, it was because I had to talk to Sinsen, but we were discussing about exactly, I think it's there. There's the moments of consciousness in Theravada. There is some, yeah, as you're saying, in Hinduism, there is all this. You made me think a lot the way you were describing it, you made me think so much about inquiry with Ramana Maharshi, like following the thought eye to the source. And
exactly.
That way, transcending
I think that's what he was describing, actually. And there's different ways of doing that. It can be done with a mantra, or it can be done in the way Ramana described and so on.
And also dependent origination, all this. I was having a conversation like this with Sinsen just this Wednesday, which he declined to comment on. Because, I don't know, but if you see his system, he just goes right to the spot, which is beautiful. He doesn't make levels. He doesn't make distinctions between people. He just shows a technique that is useful, like a razor.
And if it works, if you can do it, great.
He has all this way about how to go about it. He's super direct. So I think that's why he didn't follow me on this conversation, but he helped me to articulate something that I never said before. And it's so, so personal. I never come to think about it, which is the way that I was experiencing perception. We start talking about what perception is and so on. And I just started talking to him. And I just get the analogy of brainwaves and that how when we are, for example, now talking, our brain is certain ways. And let's say if someone will go to sleep or to meditation and you go in a deeper state, there's a more fundamental kind of way of thinking. And to me, I don't know to which extent people following this, which are meditators, are also aware of this, because I've been experiencing this mostly privately for most of the time. I have a certain kind of like direct access to this more primordial kind of way of thinking that is not, it's not thoughts. It's more like these abstract images that you,
impulses
that you see like hypnagogic imagery. These images you get before when you're falling asleep, but you're nicely, you see this kind of, it's something like that. It's geometric. That's where the conversation with Sinsen comes. And it made me realize what I'm what fractals became such an important topic and what I was saying, because it made me realize that that's why, because I sort of have this sense that how my experience comes from this grounding that we were saying, like whatever it is, let's say it's like I was trying to describe to him like a hum, you know, like a, you know, this, when you put this cymatics is the name we were going on researching words. That's what he makes me do. Cymatics is this kind of research of, you may have seen how they put a certain surfaces and they put sand, for example, or even some liquids, and you put sound, created some geometric patterns. It's fascinating, fascinating, because that's exactly to me how it feels to be, to be a person. Like there is some fundamental level where there's this force, let's say the sound in this example, and how that creates, and in that specific medium, probably this mind and this body, it creates a certain kind of shapes. This will be like their primary thoughts, and how that these thoughts, as it keeps processing, it's kind of break down into little bits. And for those of you who have been meditating long, you may have noticed this experience that you may be in a deep meditation state, let's say, in the sense that your mind is very calm and you feel everything feel very effortless. You don't need to think much about anything. And how when you're resuming your day and going back to it, you can clearly see how your mind is just like blah, blah, blah. It starts throwing meaning and thoughts. And so you're getting, there's all this conversation popping up in your mind that weren't there a few moments before. Like it all came out of that. And I think, I hope you see the parallel to what you were saying. So I'm just trying
I
to
do.
Say.
Yeah.
I think we.
But eventually, I mean, some people, their minds are like 10 radio stations playing at the same time, just a million different thoughts. And most of them are not useful or relevant to what they're doing or anything. But, eventually you can get it to a point where you don't think anywhere near as many thoughts as you used to, but the thoughts you think are useful. And so you're not wasting energy on superfluous thoughts.
Because they're not personal.
Because they're not personal?
They're not personal. I mean, I'm just going to pull out a bit of Advaita Vedanta here. Yeah. In the sense, there's this, supposedly in Advaita Vedanta, they talk, I think Rupert Spira was making this analogy. I don't know, he just put it up from somewhere else, but this idea of the ego, the I thought, is just a clown that comes after the show and takes all the pluses to itself. You know, I did that. And that's kind of, honestly, what he felt, all this latency thing. That as we were living behind, very much behind, more of this contaminated sense of I'm a separated thing, rather than imagine when you're lost in a dance, when you're lost in enjoying a moment with your family, or in a moment where you're not really thinking much. It just comes this spontaneous action. And it's mostly loving. It's mostly enjoyable. It's mostly peaceful. And these have a shorter latency. And that's the thing. Like a couple of years ago, I've been meditating at that point. Actually, that's matching with this period with Sinsen. Actually, some way I was just like focusing on my experience moment by moment, no matter what, and trying to see all these little tiny little things about the experience. And I remember I had this beautiful moment. I was at the beach with my wife. It was a little before. It was in Corona. And we just moved out of the city and went to a place where there were like huge beaches and my son could run. And there was this whole moment that was like, you cannot imagine. It was like paradise, in the sense like I just had this kind of like, I will call it like blissful natural state out of the situation. Let's say that everything was conducive to that. But at this moment, I was only looking at me. I wasn't looking about the sensory experience. I was just looking at how I was relating to it, let's say.
Right.
And at that point, that specific one, probably this happens for most people also in little compartments. For me, that one was like very clear that, as you were describing just now, there are no thoughts, actually. I mean, someone could say, if you were pulled into that experience dramatically, you clearly say, oh yeah, there's a certain, you're aware that there's absence of talking, blah, 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 inside of your mind and trying to manipulate or control your life. This sense. But also, as you were describing, the thoughts that come are more like these experiences that happens in this moment, where are just something that is happening. It's not something you're attached to it. It's just something it has a specific function and comes. This thought says its thing and it goes. That's what creative thoughts are to me. It doesn't engage into and this and that and the other in this way that if you stop the chain, it feels like you have to pull yourself out of it. Back into it. It feels like these natural thoughts, I would call them non-personal thoughts. They just come like the most natural thing. This bubbling you were discussing, just passing through your net, your personal net, your body mind, and just comes this activity or this spontaneous thought. But there's this quality of detachment from them. They are joyful. And you're okay with not thinking anymore right after. You know, there's this sense of space to it, in the sense of appreciation. Like in a museum, you have the artworks in a wall where you can actually see it. In some way, you see the thoughts and have this space around them that you can appreciate them.
Yeah. A couple of thoughts on that. Oh, thoughts. I'm having thoughts. I interviewed a guy, might have been 10 or 12 years ago, named Gary Weber. And he said one time, he had been doing spiritual practice. One time he did a yoga asana. I think he was doing a shoulder stand or something. And his mind stopped. And he said, I haven't had any thoughts since then. I just haven't had any thoughts. And I said, well, Gary, you're talking to me. You know, and talking is a verbal expression of a subtler impulse in the mind, that, you know, certain ideas that you're expressing. So I would argue that, you know, maybe it's a semantic thing of how we're defining thoughts. I would argue, like,
I know,
yeah,
I think,
go ahead.
I think you're making a very good point, and that's one of the rhetorics that I have as I go on the YouTube videos and so on. Because most people nowadays in mindfulness and meditation, like, you cannot stop your thoughts. That's stupid, trying to stop your mind, or that has nothing to do with meditation. And here's the truth. Actually, okay, we need to be a little careful how we discuss this. But at the same time, you talk to someone who had like deep meditative experiences, they will be making references, as we were just doing, about this kind of sense of silence, stillness, of grounded. But the thoughts that these thoughts that come, as in Tibetan Buddhism, they have a specific way of describing this, but it's something like, you don't engage in thinking. Thoughts come. You will have the thought, okay, I need to go to the kitchen and cook something. But it's not even personal. It's like something that is happening. You know, it's not, I go to the kitchen, to my kitchen, and gonna make my favorite meal. There is no all these extra layers to it. There is just kind of like a physiological, probably just a brain minimal action that you do. But these thoughts, like, I think many people listening to this who have been meditating and you've been observing your mind could tell about that moment where you are in regular absorbing thinking, when you're like, everything feels like you're fighting the world, you're controlling the world, everything is not as you would like it to be, and so you have to be trying to do something to be happy. And suddenly for a moment, just give yourself a break. And for many people, I hear many people describing me how they noticed that suddenly the thoughts were there, but they weren't bothered by it. And I think that's a very important distinction. So thoughts are there. But the deeper you go, first thing, thoughts become only practical or creative, or there has a reason to be. It's not a self-reflective nonsense that is useless and a waste of energy. No, the thoughts are just perfect on their own. That's the one that you are not thinking as a person, let's say. They just appear like my hands are moving. I'm not thinking about moving my hands or any word that we say. It just seems to happen, hopefully spontaneously. And making sense. But what I'm saying is that is the layers of resistance that create this delay, this latency, are layers of that creates a stronger sense of me. This security, and that resistance is what it could make you feel this exact moment as it is, to be painful, to be a fight, to be something miserable, let's say, or to have a sense that your thoughts are like your body moving when you're just dancing. You're not thinking about it, how you move every, but you're enjoying it so much. So it seems that you are dance. So in the same way, I think when you are free from this personal solid sense of artificial structure of me that you need to feed it with thoughts all the time. If you stop thinking, it just falls apart. That's where I was discussing before temporary samadhi. So to say, these techniques that are actually suggesting you don't just fucking give up on thought. Do anything you can to get it. Are actually useful because they're going to give you an open window to observe what happens if you don't feed back this structure. What is the truth if you're not trying to make it up all the time in your mind, you know, to observe directly? And I think in that space, it comes a very important revelation that is, again, nothing new. But is that if you have to go closer and closer to this latency, to this gap between what's happening and how you're interpreting it, so you start getting free and letting go of your own personal interpretation, at some point you notice that you pass that point, meaning that before you thought, I am doing this, and as you start shortening this gap between this intimacy to the experience, at some point you notice that you are there, like let's say in some sort of stillness, silence, or some kind of like being, and the experience is happening. And I think this shift of from the person who's fighting about the world, who's trying to control the world, who's trying to make the world be as you want, as you need, and with based on fear and survival, as you release that power, you realize that everything was just ridiculous from the first place. You know, sometimes with this is a conversation we had with my group of meditation, and we're talking, someone say, okay, if there is no doer, who is meditating? What's the point of sitting to meditate? And the conversation was along the lines that, here's the thing, something happens in the core of your being. You were talking about these layers of thought. Something disrupts, like the center of the epicenter of an earthquake, for example. And what you see your body sitting or not sitting to meditate, it's just waves of it. It's happening. You don't need even to try to meditate. It's just a celebration of your body and mind of something breaking deep in the core of your own mental slavery. Like it's like it happens after that glimpse that you had. Suddenly your body and your mind start, something you start like feeding back into that, let's say in your body and your mind. But it happens naturally. It shouldn't be something that you discipline yourself. You know, people recently have, normally have a lot of people tell me, no, now I can meditate 1 hour. I can sit to meditate 1 hour. And it was, I'm saying, how could I say this more carefully? Think twice before I say. Because it's more like, what's the point of forcing yourself to meditate? You know, I know. Okay. There is some initial point where you, it seems that you are collecting yourself and saying, this is good for me. I should meditate, you know? So there's an initial point that we all agree. But if you've been sitting to meditate, let's say for a few months, especially after a few years, you should be enjoying your meditation. like a bee is going back to a flower. I mean, no, there should be nothing like discipline, but more like you're visiting your lover or something like that. You're sitting there just to, now you can feel yourself.
Lots of good things there that you just said. For me, luckily or fortunately, meditation was like that from day one. It was like, and these days it's like I get to just visit heaven twice a day and I just sit in this blissful, beautiful state. And I don't sit there all day. I've got things to do, but it certainly doesn't take any discipline to sit there for an hour because it's just so sweet. Sometimes takes discipline to come out of it and do other things. And there's a principle to this, which is that, you know, we've all heard the traditions say that ananda or bliss is a characteristic of Brahman or the ultimate reality and so on. And so our minds have a natural tendency to seek a field of greater happiness. I mean, as a musician, you should know that, you know, if you're listening to some bubblegum music and then some beautiful music that you love comes from another direction, your mind is just going to shift to the good music. And this happens all day long. Talk about bees. I mean, bees do it. You know, they just kind of follow, where's the nice flower? Okay, here's one. And they go for it. All life does this. The mind has a natural tendency to seek a field of greater happiness. And the ground state of the universe and of ourselves is a state of bliss, among other things. And so if the mind could be given an opportunity to begin to go in that direction, it will encounter greater charm at each step. And that greater charm will allow it to just settle down effortlessly to a clearer and clearer experience of it. Kind of like just taking the correct angle off a diving board and letting go, to mix metaphors. So anyway,
I think you're bringing up such an important topic, because I was hearing Ram Dass recently talking about this, specifically how many of our Westerns, and the reason why mindfulness is so popular, because the Buddhist approach fits very well with our scientific. We've been burned out by all the religious crap, and we decided, okay, now science is the only thing we can trust. So all this thing coming like with the gurus, and I'm sorry, but I think, I'm going to say your generation, because you describe yourself in the 68th, right? Enjoying yourself in there, and which is beautiful. But at the same time, as we know, there's a lot of people who's this guy who has a song and say like, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? And there's the lyrics from someone else. I don't
think I know that one.
Yeah, there's a song that says that, and I always said, "Oh, that's a great lyric." Because what's so funny about this thing? I say, sorry, let me go back to the point. I was trying to say that with the hippies, and when all this like overuse of the word peace, love, happiness, you have all the Hare Krishna, you have all this thing, and we have like a wave of people using all this kind of appealing sense of I'm gonna be happy if I do this, if I follow this, if I do that, and again, of course, that just went really bad, as we know.
Yeah,
in general,
the
terms.
Theme in the '60s was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and that's where the happiness was expected to be found. And within a year or two of that, everyone got burned out, you know, and a lot of them started to turn to hard drugs and so on.
Yeah,
know?
but
I mean, and who was it? You know, Joseph Campbell says, "Follow your bliss." That doesn't mean hedonism; it means something more subtle and deep than that. It really means what I was saying a few minutes ago. There's a reservoir of inner bliss, and you want to follow that or you know, dive into that. Just one more quick thing I'm going to throw out and then let you continue. You know, you were saying meditation should be so enjoyable and everything that you should just naturally want to do it. Well, you know, we get caught up in activities and we think, well, maybe I'll just watch this TV show or maybe I'll go and do that, or because the attention is habitually directed outwards. So it might, especially in the early days of one's practice, it might take a little discipline to say, no, I can do that later. I'm just going to sit down and meditate now. And within a few minutes, you're like, okay, much better than watching the TV show.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying it's not going to just automatically happen. Sometimes you might need to just give yourself a nudge in the right direction.
Yeah.
And sometimes they might have to be more disciplined because some people are so caught up in things, maybe drug addiction or something else, that they need a little bit more vigilance to.
I know. Yeah. You know Patch Adams?
Yes. He's the clown guy. That Robin Williams played in.
Yeah, the movie. Yeah, well, for those of you who know, it was like, it's a funny movie, but it has a point that's what I'm going to be answering to you, that, about discipline. Mm-hmm. In the movie, Patch Adams basically was like healing people just by, what do you want? Oh, I want spaghetti. Okay. This is spaghetti and people will just heal. You know, there's this silly thing about it. And here's the thing. Through my music, for example, I was one of the worst students at school you could imagine.
Me too. I was like ADHD to the max, you know, looking out the window and getting distracted by every little thing.
Exactly. So I was drawn to music, and I took myself as like a really self-pleasing kind of being. As a teenager, right? I was just
self-pleasing.
Self-pleasing. Like I was just looking for this kind of, if I enjoy one ice cream, what happens if I eat 10, you know? And with drugs too, of course. You were bringing up a very important point with a lot of confusion, because in one side of the story, people think, okay, you have one side of the spectrum with this Buddhism influence and mindfulness. You should be kind of like, there's this sense of neutrality. Like you hear people saying, I'm enlightened and I'm still depressed. You have all this kind of people saying that stuff. Like to me, it's very Buddhist, although there's a lot of Neo-Advaita people also talking like that. And so one side, you have people who say like, your life shouldn't change at all. Like if you're miserable, you should still keep miserable even when you're enlightened.
These guys like Chogyam Trungpa, who's an alcoholic, and you know, he's enlightened, but he's killing himself with alcohol. He's like,
And then the other side of the story, you have people who are saying, no, meditation is just to feel bliss. So your life sucks. Your boss sucks. Relationship sucks. You hate your guts and you're trying just to get there to do some yoga and just some meditation just to feel good for a little bit, you know? So that's the other side of the spectrum where looking for meditation to give you something that you are denying yourself as a whole. So I think there are reasons why some people would say, because I think very much on the line of what you were saying, that meditation should be pleasant. If it's not pleasant, and by that, I think, at least in my case, I mean that, meditation, let's say the blissful aspect of meditation is kind of like a side effect of meditation rather than the goal of meditation. But it's important to recognize it, because otherwise you hear all these people. I mean, now the younger generation are talking about being awakened. And I think they are picking this word and they're just like an awareness and they're turning into something else. And the people say that I awakened we are the awakened generation. And some people go on YouTube, I hear some people talking about they were awakened. And there were people who were like miserably alone with social anxiety, with huge amounts of depression. And they were pointing, yeah, but I'm awakened because this life is not real and so on. And
that's
so
just the concept. It's not.
That's kind of basically the thread of my YouTube channel is to actually go on that line and say, hey, wait a minute. Let's not make stuff. Because one thing, it is true that as you release your suffering, you become blissful. But this blissful is not something you look as a goal. Let's say you don't use meditation as escape, you know, because that there will be the danger of some, let's say, as again, some Buddhists will say, yeah. But if you sit and you try to your life sucks and you try to sit to meditate and get yourself into, well, it could be more Buddhist than the jhanas, right? Just go there and just please yourself because you can close your eyes and absorb yourself into a state and you, wow. And what the Buddha basically said, like, yeah, what happens when you get out of that? You can bliss yourself out in that high concentration meditation, which is an incredible skillful thing to do. So bravo to anyone who's able to do that. At the same time, you still wake up and you were talking about teachers. And this is a conversation that I had with Shinsen. I think Shinsen is a great person to talk about this because he talks the truth about, he's very human. So he doesn't give a fuck about, oh, my teacher said, you know, like say, my teacher was the most fuckhead person I ever met. You know, he talked about all these abuses and scandals and things like that. But just to join at some point in the conversation, I have that conversation in the middle with him. Because he's always talking about how all these meditation teachers are way beyond perfect. And they have all these huge problems, all these gurus, you know, all these scandals in the spiritual community. But I was telling him, I was asking him, yeah, but he wasn't conscious when he did that. So what that tells us, this great advanced people who were able to do something pretty much athletic and they had certain kind of profound understanding about reality even. Still, they have these blanks where they behave like, as they didn't have these filters of behaving correctly, they didn't give much a crap about that. And they were probably in a position where, I mean, my Shinsen's teacher was a Zen monk. And to train as a Zen monk, you basically go through torture. So these people are psychologically tortured. And they have this kind of, I don't know how to describe it, a bit of like people who have been living through concentration camps or something like that, have been abused.
Trauma.
Yeah, they have something in there that still needs to work out. So some of these people, for example, in Sinas, they still have this kind of incredible achievements and understanding about very complex and fascinating things. They may still have these gaps, but this is where it comes to conversation. So shouldn't be blissful. There is responsibility. I don't know if I'm bringing up a very broad topic right now, but I was trying to discuss about this idea that I suggest people, and I talk about love. I dare to talk about love to people and happiness and stuff like that, because it seems to be like, you shouldn't be talking so much about that. I mean, at first, what do you think, Ricky?
Well, this is a big topic for me. I helped to establish an organization called the Association for Spiritual Integrity, because I have encountered so much lack of integrity in spirituality. So many teachers have been hypocritical, to say the least, in terms of the discrepancy between their public face and their private life. And I naively and optimistically feel that a spiritual practice should enhance your life and make you a better person. How old-fashioned, you know? I think you should naturally become more loving, more compassionate, more ethical, happier, which is not to say that, you know, you might not have depression or other issues. You're a human being and you have a neurophysiology that can get influenced by things that can cause depression. But, you know, in general, I mean, it's fair to speak of generalities. Someone who is claiming to be enlightened or awakened or anything like that, if those words mean anything, is not going to be a sexual predator or abusive or, you know, a drug addict or an alcoholic or any of those things. And if they are those things and yet they are really enlightened, then I'm not interested in enlightenment. So you can have it. I don't want it.
Yeah.
So I'll just be a regular guy and hopefully, you know, a decent one. So
That's a great That's a great initiative. And I think, as you probably know, Shinsen is kind of on the same side of the story. You know, like, I think it's beautiful that some of you are really taking an active part to clean up the bad fame of spirituality in communities. Yeah. I personally detach myself from any kind of spiritual communities for more than 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know if I have, I have always been impressed by the Taoist model of enlightenment.
The Taoist.
Yeah, like the role model figure, someone enlightened will be someone who will be like a shoemaker or something like that. You know, it's not
could
someone
be.
Who goes.
I mean, you know, it doesn't have to be a shoemaker. He could be a scientist or a musician. It doesn't have to be doing a simple job.
Exactly. What I was trying to say is that for the first stage, that, and I really appreciate all that, but my wife, who is really not into that, but she always keeps me grounded in so many ways. But participating in spiritual communities, not at the level of, I've never seen anything, let's say, really out of line, and I've been like in dangerous. Funny story, my mother got me brainwashed.
Into what?
No, brainwashed, sorry, but the expression is like, when someone is like kept by a sect.
Right.
So my mother had to make an intervention.
Oh, because you were in some kind of sex?
Because I was in some weird stuff.
Uh-huh.
So my mother was creeped out because I was always doing
this
stuff.
In other words, your mother, you were brainwashed and your mother had you deprogrammed.
Yeah, that's exactly, that's right. The word that I was looking for. Yeah, that's supposed what it was happening. But the funny story is that, because at that point I was working on the fourth path, you know?
Familiar with it, I don't think. Is that a Gurdjieff Ouspensky thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I heard of it.
These people work in a very private level. So you just kind of find them randomly. And the relationship with them in my mind, it was very strange because they would kind of like would dress for the occasion. It was everything very, for my mind, was like ringing so wrong.
Yeah.
And, but the truth is that to me, I never had any problem with them, but they were working in a kind of structure that it seemed to, yeah, fall into that category of dangerous sex and so on. But the truth is, so my mother got the most, like mothers are when they are looking for their babies, let's say.
She got a respected deprogrammer.
Exactly. She got the best in Spain. And I was talking, I had to make these trips to Barcelona to talk to this person. And she was giving me books about how sex brainwash you and what is a destructive sect, you know. And I was reading all that and saying, like, I don't understand. That's like any religion. Literally everything that's written there as a sect. And the person who was leading this was supposedly reprogramming me. She was an ex-nun. Mm-hmm. And the conversation went a bit strange because I was saying, okay, I really want to believe you. Honestly, I don't care. I just give up to this group. No problem. I'm not attached to anything. But she kept like digging in. I started asking her about her when she was trying to bring me ideas of why these sects were dangerous, or they were like getting into telling me how I should treat my family or how I should treat the people, or in which way they could be like misleading, like talking about the end of the world and all. I was talking, yeah, but can you tell me a bit more about your life as a nun?
Right.
And she was telling me, like, can you explain to me why it's different? You know? So anyway, the story goes like, I just dropped that. I just did it. I didn't matter because I was more into the actual integration rather than attached to certain teachings. So I went out of that and I went through Course in Miracles. I went through rebirthing. I've been through many different angles, and participating in all these communities also gave me a sense that something was profoundly wrong in these communities.
Yeah.
In the sense that, and again, I never had a bad experience, but there was something like ritualistic, fake.
Mm-hmm.
And there were many people who were not really trying to go there to do the work, but they were, when you go into these places, and I've been to many different kind of groups, they were all saying these words, and they all have this idea of what is to be good, and which, you know, there's the kind of this way of talking about things that is kind of creepy. And at the same time, they are beautiful people. They just have, I think sometimes they just need to belong to something. I think that's the danger in this sect or spiritual groups thing, that people can sometimes, they have like problems in their emotional life, that can be dangerous if there is someone up there that who would take advantage of that from their money, actually, or for sexually, or as you know, all these kind of episodes we have. But anyways, I just saying that my wife said, was like, oh, why'd you go? That place is where you go is like kind of like groups of therapy or something. And I said, like, you're kind of right. We're all nuts. I mean, it looks like we are so spiritual and looking for this enlightenment thing of model above people, but actually we are as screwed as anyone else or even more because we're looking for happiness where my neighbor is just enjoying himself and I'm trying harder to meditate to whatever it is, the thing that we were doing. But anyways, I just want to say that at some point in my path, it became very important to be alone. So I realized that all these backgrounds weren't really supporting me because of these dynamics that happens in the spiritual worlds. And so I went on my own. I just wanted to check to which extent I really understood on my own. So I stopped talking to spirituality for probably 10 years and I didn't have even a conversation, not even with my wife about it. And I was meditating every day, you know, three times. And so it's not that I dropped the whole thing. I knew what I was doing, but I just had a strong sense of detaching myself from anything spiritual and finding myself because I was finding people who were more real and they had nothing spiritual. Like people you could see in their eyes, you could see the way they talk, you can see in the way they do things in life, you can see in their motivation. And I realized that, okay, these people are more real than all these people who are supposed to be spiritual. So I kind of went on this solo trip for actually I'm still there. In the sense that I never went back to any group. I keep it there. I just started organizing groups of meditation long time ago, just because I realized people didn't know anything about meditation and people didn't have resources to sit to meditate anywhere really, or at least everything was or Buddhist or in certain kind of strongly cultural influenced traditions and things like that. So I wanted to create an environment for that. So I did that here, but it was, so I just got in contact with people who, for example, Alan Wallace, and some other teacher, and then now Sinsen. So I'm pretty much kind of detached from spiritual communities, although I think it's very important to have, this is my personal view, is can be very beneficial to have a relationship with someone who knows better than you. That I think, yeah, that's a really good idea. On the other hand, I don't think it's necessary. I think it's beneficial for many people. So I'm not saying I'm not suggesting that this should be everybody's experience. But I think a bit of more honesty in the spiritual path, in spiritual communities will be really good. And I say we're climbing back from this conversation about bliss, because that's the place where nowadays I've been a couple of times here with my wife in these events where people do ecstatic dance and all this stuff. And this go into the basic people are looking for this kind of cathartic space, which I think is really cool. But at the same time, I think they just stop too soon, I would say, in the sense they are looking for like experience, if it was a drag or if it was something. And I think that's the thing with maybe if we have to restructure the understanding of meditation and spiritual communities, I think we should be careful to understand when we're looking for escapism from our lives because your life sucks and you try to go for a place to get in an alter state because you cannot deal with your own thoughts and your minds. I think that's useful. It can be very therapeutical if done with someone who is making therapy with that. I'm not saying that it's fantastic, shamanism, for example. But at the same time, I think we should just keep it grounded to what I tell most of the people that I coach is like, because that you basically, what you're doing is just cleaning your basement. That's how your meditation should feel like in the beginning, especially because in the beginning is a lot like trying to reach a higher state of, they're kind of waiting. Okay, when I'm going to get this bliss you're talking about? Asking me, when is that going to happen for me? And I say, okay, you know what? Sorry to mislead you. I didn't mean like that. I'm saying it's important for you to know that's going to happen. So don't get too much used to your crap and to your psychosis and all that. Just let that go. You don't need to stay with that. Just focus on just rebalancing. What I've been working a lot is with samatha. That's one of the nicest things I ever found. So I'm so incredibly grateful to Alan Wallace and Chula Dasa for the two books. I don't know, in case someone in here doesn't know about these books, is Alan Wallace wrote The Attention Revolution and Chula Dasa wrote The Mind Illuminated. And I was so thankful for them because they were able to bring all this tremendous technology into the use of anyone. And what I like from this methodology is that you just go back to the object. There is no this and that and the other and the Four Noble Truths. No, you just go back to the object. And I realized, okay, this is what we all need. And this is in this age of overstimulation and over We all the time like in this desperate looking for things that make me happy, for ways to fix it myself, and you know, it's just go back to the object. So yeah, that may feel temporarily, but what I like you're dealing with your shit. So it may not be nice in the sense that yeah, that's the thing you're trying to avoid every time you go on these pleasures, escapism, like yeah. So yeah, you see the meditate. Yeah, in one side, I don't expect it to be bliss in the sense of like the meditation gonna make you blissful. That's not how it works. But just sit there and just make your laundry, clean. Let go of all these chains of thoughts that are really not serving you, and just pick something as simple as your breath, or it could be a mantra, as you very well know. It could be anything. Just make a conscious decision, and notice how much you are unconscious because of all these flows of thoughts that are just pushing you away, and you think you're conscious, you think you're managing your life, but actually if you stop for a while and just experience yourself, I think that's a space where meditation allows you to do that. All the techniques one way or another allows you to realize that you're not yourself. You're experiencing a very messy, meaningless entropy of thinking experience. And meditation, so in this way, going back to the original point of the meditation, may feel like it's uncomfortable. It will bring all the time, continuously, people report all this somatic experience, like you were meditating. Why I'm feeling like this now? I'm feeling these physical experiences. Some people would say, I even feel pain in here. Or I had a friend who had tremendous pain in his hands while on a retreat meditating. And all these somatic, yeah, that's normal. That's part of the process. That the part probably is very helpful to be around people who've been through that, because you realize it just doesn't matter. Let it go. And that's, but if you just keep cleaning, so to say, you're not really creating the bliss. You're rediscovering with the words of my book, by shortening that latency, but just resting in what's happening as it happens. And that's what's for me meditation, in the sense that it just brings you, just helps you release. So I say this to this topic we're discussing, meditation, blissful, not blissful. So should it be pleasant? Should it not be pleasant? Should it be like pushing yourself for your own trauma? How should it feel? Well, different techniques will push in different directions, but mostly what I'm trying to say is that, yeah, it may feel initially, especially in the beginning, it feels like, oh, this thing of going back to the object seems like the most tedious, boring thing to do in the world. And it can even become, if you're someone who has suffered, and you have accumulated these deep tensions, you may even having this kind of outburst of something uncomfortable. But hopefully you're working with someone who can lead you, or this system of the 10 stages, who make very discrete point, just keep going through. Then things are going to start clearing up. And then the bliss you're going to find is not a bliss that you have manufactured because you did a technique meditation. It's the natural bliss that was covered with a lot of contradiction and distraction.
Good. Yeah, that was great. There are two main points in what you said that I want to comment on. One is about groups, you know, spiritual groups, which become cult-like. Do you know who the Marx Brothers were? Those comedians from many years ago? Maybe you don't.
But there was the Marx Brothers?
The Marx, M-A-R-X.
Of course.
One of them was Groucho Marx, and Groucho said, I wouldn't want to join a club that would accept me as a member. And so it's weird about groups and organizations. I mean, almost all of them have some kind of cult-like qualities. I think some are way worse and some are better, but there's always something. There's always sort of an in-group way of thinking and speaking and talking and dressing and eating and all that stuff. And it's funny because when you're in such a group, it's like the frog in the warming water. You know, you don't realize that it's getting warmer and warmer because it's going gradually. Groups can get so weird, and you're part of it, and you don't even realize how weird it is, or how weird it appears to people on the outside. They're the ones who look weird because they're not like you. So anyway, I would just sort of be cautious, caution anyone on the spiritual path that don't totally avoid teachers in groups, but be discerning. And if a teacher is behaving strangely or inappropriately, don't rationalize that, you know, you are stupid and he's enlightened, and so you should ignore your own common sense. You know, get up and leave, or call him on his stuff, you know, if he's misbehaving in some way. So anyway, that's that point. Then the other thing about bliss, I think you kind of have to earn bliss in a way, because the mind and body are correlated. And if our mind is in a kind of confused, foggy state, there's a corresponding neurophysiological basis for that mental condition, namely that the physiology is full of impurities, impressions, and so on, which, you know, sometimes called samskaras in Sanskrit, and there's all kinds of terminology for it. But the spiritual path is actually a journey of housekeeping, house cleaning, where you have to purify your whole mind-body system, both gross and subtle body, and it doesn't happen overnight. And as it happens, there's going to be a release of impurities, and that can cause upsurges of anxiety or anger or depression or physical discomfort, all kinds of things. And it's good to recognize it for what it is. And perhaps you can do some supplementary things such as, I don't know, yoga or massage or exercise or whatever to help facilitate the purification. But it's got to happen in order for any kind of abiding state to be achieved. And so don't think that it's just going to be all roses, you know, or daffodils and unicorns. There's got to be a whole catharsis that takes place, a purification. And it's a lifelong process, really, because there's no end to it, which is not to say, I mean, there was some Zen story about some guy polishing a brick or something, expecting it to become a mirror. It's not like that. It's not like no end to it means you're never going to reach some kind of desirable state. It just means that, you know, you're never going to be perfect. You know, you're a human being, and human bodies aren't perfect. Human minds aren't perfect. So there's always going to be some further refinement and purification that can take place. And you're never above and beyond the obligation to continue to do that, and also to continue to watch your own behavior. One of my favorite quotes, which I've used a million times, you've probably heard me use it, is from Padmasambhava, who said, "Although my awareness is as vast as the sky, my attention to karma is as fine as a grain of barley flour." And so what he's saying is he's in a pretty good state, but it doesn't give him a free license to do whatever he wants. He has to be meticulously careful about his behavior, because even in a very high state of consciousness, you can screw up and you're going to like end up regressing or losing ground that you have arduously gained if you get careless like that.
And he's going to be a big screw up.
It can be. I mean, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, you know?
No, I say this because sometimes we are very easy to judge. We're in a position where we haven't been, for example, talking about some of these teachers who have been abused, who have misused funds, for example, or something like that.
Or misused women or whatever.
Yeah. Honestly, I think, honestly, they had it so easy to do. So I say, because sometimes we like to feel, oh yeah, how these people could do that. Well, honestly, I think maybe from where they were, it was a bit more difficult than it looked. So much respect for everyone who's trying to do their best and fail in the way.
As they say, they're but for the grace of God go I, you know. We none of us are beyond the possibility of some kind of fall.
But you brought something that I don't know if you want me to ask. You wanted
yeah,
to
sure.
ask me, but it has to do with the book.
Oh yes, please.
Because
go ahead.
We discuss about latency,
mm-hmm.
but I'm very much that's what I really like you, Rick, because you acknowledge stages, and we've been talking about this process of deepening and samskaras and so on. But there's a problem that I have to be all the time kind of explaining people, because when you get someone presented to this idea, you say, you will never really gonna get it. For many people, oh, I'm a stage one. I've been meditating for many years, and now you're coming here in your system, and I'm just a stage one. And it feels really hard on their ego. But here's the thing. Normally I tell them, no, wait, but relax. You're way better than you think you are, because the stages are fractals.
Aha, good boy.
We tend to think them as something linear you do in time. If you want me to something very simple, it would be more like something you're deepening down here and now. That we go again back into this latency modes. So the stages are not something that kind of traps you or limits you or something that you may judge yourself. They are orientative symptoms that may happen. It may be helpful to you to orientate. And if someone comes and tell me, I don't need stages, I'll say, oh, fantastic. You may not need them. You are the only judge to know yourself if you're really free from suffering or what you're doing is working, you don't need to have the stages. Stages are not there to trap you into a system. On the contrary, they are just this incredible bulk of value that people before us doing the same thing have found. I think it's such a irresponsible thing for new generations to just drop all these cultural things out of the context just because it's Buddhist, just because it's Hindu, just because that. I think we need to make an effort. That's kind of what I'm trying to do, to bring and tell people, guys, these people really rocked. Like, they really know everything about how is the process. If you do this in certain, so they created these incredible maps. So you don't need them. If you feel that you can go there straight, one step, please be my guest, do it. But if you fall and you need some support, yeah, here's the thing. So I've been presenting a Samatha for many years. Now I'm presenting Anapanasati. I'm making a kind of like a brave move in there. But just to explain to you, no, guys, this is here to help you and not to trap you. And it's not that you're going to become, it's that you're going to notice that there's this apparent thing that you were mentioning, this experience where you still feel that you're walking the path. So you still feel, in the sense, you haven't completed, you haven't become the ultimate enlightened being on earth finally, because you reached that stage or whatever. Now you feel that you're there, you're doing your laundry, cleaning your thing, but you're already here and there and everywhere, as the Beatles will say. Mm-hmm. That you feel that you already completed the path, that you are the path itself.
But the goal is all along the path, you could say. The goal is all along the path.
You find yourself being very patient. And I don't know if I get this from anyone at some point, reading so much and doing so many things. But I always tell some of my coaches, the moment you're ready to wait forever, that's the moment that eternity finds you. Just there. In the moment that you say, I'm okay being a level one meditator. That very moment where you say, yeah, okay, you know, you just made peace with who you are in the sense of personal of body. This is not obviously everything that you are, but just for a second, just let yourself be and being this person who is learning and just walking this path. And it's not perfect, but it's just going through that. And just there at the moment that you accept yourself and make peace with that, it comes a dimension of peace. Like suddenly your life turns, instead of being a nightmare that you're trying to control, your dream of things that happen to you and so on with manifestation and so on, suddenly you start saying, wait, I'm here, I'm dreaming. But at the same time, there's this sense of light that it doesn't belong, this timelessness that doesn't belong to the dream. So you're living this kind of strange parallel experience of being nothing and being everything, of being a person and not being a person. So I think you expressed it very well with Padmasambhava. So for me, that's fractal. That's what I go into fractals, because fractals is a scientific, and this is one of the things that Sinsen has actually been helping me to do, because I wouldn't have done all this without him. That it helped me to understand that the way you have to talk to people nowadays is to ground in science. Because not because of science is a new religion, which is kind of is in many cases, but because these mathematical laws, there is something about physics, there is something about mathematics, there is something that is actually does help the mind behave in a different way. And that's something that can be communicated even beyond crossing cultural barriers. I say this because he's working with Chinese, with the Russians. He's doing all this thing, working on this model of communication that is based on this. So, of course, this has influenced me on taking this thing, this side that, as I explained before, that I'm not, my mind doesn't think, I don't consider myself scientist at all, because I'm too busy making music, not because I think they don't want to say anything. I love science when I read about it and I learn it. Now, of course, Sinsen is making, open my eyes to see, wow, new mathematics are really, really fascinating. So, but for example, when I try to implement, I think I'm in the mission of bringing up this cultural grade maps, so to say, and I want to make them useful to new generations. And one of the reasons why I'm bringing up Anapanasati, which for those of you who don't know, is a system of 16 stages that the Buddha designed, let's say, 2,500 years ago. Because honestly, that it really fits very, 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 very precise with my experience of the process, and it's done in the most gentle way. It's genius. It's genius to the level that is fascinating to me. And these are not really stages like accomplishments, are just descriptions of what happens if you do this. If you do this, this happens. So it's an incredible value in terms of as a compass to orientate yourself when you're trying to see, okay, how you go. So what I'm trying to do is to put all this, bringing it out of the Buddhist context, and trying to present what I've been working for a long time, which is to synthesize, make a universal tool, so to say, a way of accessing all these devices in a simple way like Zen, but at the same time in a complex way like Samatha, as we were discussing before, some other systems that have all these very complex things going on at the same time, and since you'll be on the path to go somewhere, how to integrate that in a way that anyone can use anytime without the cultural baggage. That's what the work that I've been doing. I just discovered that. So there's the path. I normally tend to say that close to every practice that I know, that I ever known of, every path that I've been investigating for all these years, it all fall into one of the three. The stillness path that I call it, that is what I call it, the direct path, or the bliss path, that's more like tantric and so on, or art, actually, or the understanding inside path, which obviously has a lot to do with Vipassana or Advaita Vedanta. And I always find that anywhere you go, it's just normally some of these paths have a combination of elements from all these. So I just got into synthesizing this, but when I was trying to teach this to people, I say, oh my God, this is so long. It would take me years to go through all these stages. Then I say, okay, what? So I just come across again to the Anapanasati and say, wow, these stages are so genius because you can devise, for example, things that we were discussing now from the letting go of all, you were talking about the samskaras, this kind of deep rooted aspects of our conditioning. But you also, you can talk about bliss, and he discussed different levels of bliss. It's beautiful. And I think it's very useful. And I don't know if you really, I'm just dropping this thing in here that I'm super excited about this. And I'm hoping this is getting contagious and someone there kind of revisits and gets re-inspired by all these models of people who've been doing this before us. And I think probably the way to keep all this alive is by bringing into correlating your direct experience with all these teachings. And okay, just pick whatever really worked for you and transmit to others what works for you in the context of what all these geniuses have been saying. I don't know. Do you understand what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I have some thoughts on what you said. First of all, Adyashanti often used to say it, and I've heard others say, it's always good to have the attitude of a beginner. And he himself lived that way. Not that he was a beginner, but there was a certain humility. And at a certain point, a couple of years ago, he said, okay, I have to stop teaching because I'm in a lot of physical pain from problems I have. And I'm also experiencing a lot of anxiety, and I'm taking anti-anxiety medication. Now, how many spiritual teachers would admit that, you know?
Yeah.
I was very impressed when he did that. And these days he's been living in the mountains and running for hours a day and just getting in great physical shape. He even grew his hair out. So this attitude of a beginner, we're all beginners relative to what is possible. I mean, you know, Ramana Maharshi was a beginner compared to what some beings in this universe may be, you know, or gods, if you want to buy into that whole thing. So and there's a certain safety valve in having that attitude. It's culture's humility.
When you I certainly don't describe myself as a teacher ever. And I don't think I will ever.
Maybe you could consider yourself a coach, a friend, you know.
A coach, because I've been doing this as a profession with music. I've been coaching musicians since I was 13 years old, actually. I never really worked in a bar like many people did in their teenagehood. I've just been coaching people all the time. So nice. I realized that because music, as you know, is very practical. That's what one of the things that I really love from music. It's not theory. It's just one device around what music really is, let's say. So it has its own use, but just whenever it's needed. If it's not needed, it's a problem that you think in the middle of an improvisation, let's say. So that got me to the side. So that's what I've been doing extensively for the last, I don't know, a lot of years, but professionally since a long time. So I'm always open. Someone comes and I don't have anything specifically to teach. I don't have an idea what a person should do, you know? So I just follow whatever is there. And I don't have a path in the sense I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not an anything. And I damn appreciate all of them and I love all of them. But I think that's important to have this sense that you can just freely decide what works, works, and what doesn't work, then, okay, that doesn't work. And from that point of view, I think the work we are doing, you're talking about this beginner mind, this exploring mind, maybe he's living that. He may say, I'm having in my body an experience like anxiety. And we all think, oh, that means he's not a master. But maybe he's experiencing in a completely different way that someone will experience it. I'm saying this because there's this, anything could be anything. There's no meaning to anything. What is the meaning of this situation, that situation? So, you know, it's just popping in my head because I didn't went through it, but something that I really enjoy talking about is A Course in Miracles, because I think it has a lot of points that I think other traditions haven't stated so clearly. And the workbook of the A Course in Miracles starts from the very beginning. First, lesson one, I think it is, or one and second, is something like, you go around everything you see and you say, this object, you go through the objects and you say, everything I see, I have created all the meaning that it has to me. And I think that's so damn genius. It just goes straight to the point. I say this because judging ourselves as a human experience, it doesn't make much sense. I say this because I think they say never say never, but I think I will never say that I'm enlightened or I'm awakened or I will put because it feels limiting to me. Yep. To have a label as if there is something that you have to. I think the life is way more beautiful and mysterious.
It makes it sound like you've reached some end point, you know?
Yeah.
It has this static, superlative connotation, like, okay, I can hang up my running shoes. I'm just relaxing now because I'm totally there. No, yeah. There's always going to be something more.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. You're making me think of Byron Katie. You know Byron Katie?
Sure.
You never had her, right?
I had her scheduled 3 times, and 3 times she canceled rather at the last minute with no explanation or apology.
Yeah.
So I haven't tried to get her again.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but nevertheless, she was asked this question and as she was experiencing, and she told that she was feeling that so far.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. Like, yeah, okay. I think if spiritual teachers or spiritual people who accomplish stuff, which, yeah, you did that, but what if now you don't?
Right. Yeah. A couple more thoughts on what you've been saying. So regarding traditions, you know, ancient traditions, and let me just add for those of you who are listening to the live stream, I forgot to mention this in the beginning. If you would like to ask a question, there is a link in the description field underneath this video. And if you click on that, you'll go to a page through which you can submit your question. Anyway, regarding traditions, I think there's a lot of valuable stuff in them, like as you were saying, but also there's a lot of weird stuff. I mean, maybe a lot of it is metaphorical or mythological. Like, did a monkey really pick up a mountain and carry it, you know, from the Himalayas down to Sri Lanka to help, you know, Lord Rama? I mean, yeah, okay, maybe, but maybe it's just a cool story. The Buddha said something. He said, you know, don't accept something just because it's in some old book, and don't accept something because I said it. You know, work it out for yourself. Give it some thought. You know, it should concur with your own direct experience. I'm paraphrasing roughly, but he said something like that. Yeah. And that's where science comes in, because religion has been filled with all kinds of crazy ideas. Before science came along, I mean, you could be burned at the stake for believing that the stars were other suns like our own and they might have planets around them. You know, someone was burned at the stake for espousing that. Giordano Bruno was his name. And so science came along, and with the concept of the working hypothesis, where everything can be taken as a hypothesis and it has to kind of stand on the accumulated merit of empirical evidence. And if the empirical evidence is not available, then perhaps it's not a right idea. And nothing is ever final. Nothing is ever perfect. Things can always be changed. You know, all crows are black, but if we see an albino crow, we can no longer say that. So I think that spirituality could do very well to incorporate a scientific attitude based upon direct experience and not believing things that you can't experience. And on the other hand, I think that science could benefit a lot from spirituality because in many respects, science has a very superficial understanding of life. It doesn't realize that there are all these subtle realms and God and all that other stuff. But spiritual practices can actually be scientific methods to empirically explore those kinds of things.
Well, all of them are deluded in the end, right? Meaning that the principle of science is that there is someone who knows and is external to an experiment and can conclude a certain concept that represents the truth some way, of
right.
course.
Right. So it has its limits because there's always going to be a dichotomy or a duality.
Yeah, there's this arrogance from the beginning, and that I know my father-in-law is a great scientist, and I've been of course since then too, in the sense that people who really understand science, they will never say they know the truth.
Right.
They will never go for stating, no, this is what the experiment showed. No, they will say,
we have a lot of evidence. It's a pretty good hypothesis, you know.
Talk in a way that say, but they never say a strong statement that will this is the truth or something like that. Like,
well, unfortunately, many of them do, and that's called scientism. And there are people like Dean Radin who do all this great research on psi phenomena and things like that.
Yeah, but it's like,
scientists won't even look at it because they say it can't be true. I'm not going to look at it.
One of the reasons why I have never been so strong on science is because I've been through some experiences when I was young, and I got to blend, you would say, the sleepings. I had a lot of lucid dreams and out-of-body experiences and stuff like that. But I was having them like every night for a long time. And at some point, literally, my experience of being awake start blending the sense of this is not ultimate reality. This is just an experience that I'm having. It started becoming so common that for me, since then, I wouldn't take anything inside of my perception as the ultimate truth ever.
Right.
In the sense, that's why I have had a hard time to follow science. I love science for the reasons we're discussing because it's practical, it goes to the spot, and it doesn't have any blurry thing. It's trying to get clarity out of life. So that's really, really good. It's a very important aspect. And as you know, in meditation, that's vipassana. That is the clarity, the knowing, the understanding. But in the other hand, you said spirituality, but I would say it is more like art to me. So for me, the dichotomy is between art and science. None of them are right. None of them are fully right. None of them are fully wrong. I mean, science will be very on spot, very statistically provable and testable and so on. So very much on spot. But at the same time, science cannot explain you what love is or what consciousness is. So you still, okay, we need more answers. And then we have the devotional part of art where you are just feeling, you're noticing everything more from your heart, and then what you think is not so relevant. The fact that you tell this is a conversation, or this is of you, or you understand this, you play with the perception when you do art, or you're creative. You're basically making not new associations, but different associations for the ones that you have. In this case, we may have a conversation related to a book, or in this case, we are just deluding people. We're just meaning that there are many different ways of how to see what's happening. And I think that's the beauty of art, that you sit in there and science is all about doing something practical. And art is all about doing the most impractical thing ever. Do the unnecessary, do something just because you want to do it, because you feel like doing it. Even you look like an idiot, just go for it, you know, and just enjoy yourself. So I think they complement in this, and I see that in meditation, like intensifying this clarity aspect, this understanding, this insight. But at the same time, what I think many times Buddhism, not all Buddhism, because you have Tibetan Buddhism that certainly clearly integrates aspects of this other side where they understand about bliss. They understand about all the things that is difficult to scientifically talk about, and yet is the most profound direct experience you some way can have, at least without your mind to some extent. But, you know, it's this kind of living these two things. And this is more what is for me like the releasing part of meditation. So there is one that is clarity, and there is releasing. and there is clarity. That's what I see in all of the systems. They are working some way, leaning towards these two things. So people who go for dry insight or try to, like philosophers, or try to go in this kind of like narrow aspect of the story, they're still missing a huge part of their own experience and neglecting that. And that leads them to go into some vicious circles where they still not get it. The same way for the other way, the people you were discussing about devotion and how people would just believe something because it feels good to think that someone came out of blue and could fly and could do things. It feels inspiring to me. Why not? I mean, the whole Bible, it could be said that it's written like that. It's just a beautiful story. You know, it's just the whole thing. It is true. It's not true. It doesn't matter. It's not the point. You know, it's something else that it's talking about. It's talking to a different part of your mind. And I think the complementarity between this recognition of clarity and at the same time, this letting go, it is, to me, if you ask me, that's the core of all these meditations. That's what, for me, I would even say mindfulness, my interpretation of it in a practical sense, is it, you need that, because when someone lets go too much and you go into the blissful side of story and you feel like, I sit to meditate and I, you know, okay, that's good. That's better than just being stressed and running around life trying to get somewhere. But at the same time, you're still not noticing where are the roots of the samskaras, as you said, of all this thing that keeps driving you crazy on a daily basis and keep you creating a lot of suffering for you and probably for other people. But at the same time, if you go only on the, I'm just going to think my way through spirituality. So that's where we go into Buddhism mostly, you know, because it had this scientific way about everything. And it seems like, yeah, but sometimes you read the forums, Buddhist forums, and you say, oh my God, what is wrong with these people? You know, it's like they have really uncomfortable experiences, I would say, because they are kind of exposing themselves to the trauma of, for example, of impermanence when you're not ready for it. You didn't let go of your personal vision and you're trying to understand that you're fucking going to die and everyone you love and the whole world is going to disappear. You cannot talk to your little mind like that. It's going to break. It's going to have a heart attack. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that the feeling I was getting as I was listening to you is that life is multifaceted, multidimensional, and so are we. And you know that old saying of you should dig one deep well rather than 10 shallow wells, you know, if you want to hit water. But there's another way of looking at it, which is like maybe use 10 different tools to dig one deep well. You know, you need a jackhammer, you need a pickaxe, you need a shovel, you need different tools. So, you know, you're talking about science and art and religion and this and that and all kinds of different practices. Now, I don't think we should be dilettantes and just flit about, you know, trying a little of this and the practice and a little of that practice. But I think for each of us, we can develop a toolbox that includes a number of different things that covers different aspects of life and of our makeup. So there can be an intellectual component. There can be a heart component. You know, there can be a physical component. And I suppose Buddhist tradition, certainly the Hindu tradition, has all these things with bhakti and jnana and then, you know, hatha yoga and different practices that deal with different aspects of life. And you could say that, you know, if you pull any one leg of the table, the whole table and all the other legs will come along. But maybe sometimes it's better to grab a couple legs at the same time to pull the table. I think we can each formulate an approach that suits us personally. And I think there are certain critical components, you know, that almost should be universal. One is development of critical thinking skills, because it can easily get off on some tangent if you don't do that. But it's nice to have some devotional aspect. It's nice to have some effective way of settling into a very deep state, you know, samadhi or whatever you want to call it. It's good to keep your body healthy. It's good to keep getting proper exercise. It's good to have, you know, family, nice relationships. All these different things make a life. And every day is life. And we don't want to pass over the present for some glorious potential future.
Yeah. And it changes over time, right? So there will be times where you are deep into this certain kind of... But to me, that is like, you know, these experiments where they just give little kids... in the daycare or something like that, they did an experiment, which I think is pretty brutal. You give them options to eat. And yes, what the scientists realized that is that the kids would, for example, when they were sick, they will eat certain things rather than others. Meaning that kind of was proving that there's a certain kind of intuition to, it's not just, so I think when we talk about spiritual practice, the reason why I think what you're saying is very important and meaningful is because we all are on our own. So yes, we're going to find friends and people and paths to stay in there for a while. And some of them for a very long time, but ultimately, as actually the Buddha said, you're on your own. You have to be your own light, right? And but what I'm saying is that that's also what I think of myself as a coach, because I don't have like a predefined way of telling people, this is how it's going to be for you. You know, I don't know. You don't know either. We're just here having a lot of fun and we're just spontaneously going through, okay, let's do this, let's do that. And things just turn into one way or another. And what is shocking to me is, for example, people who were like scientists, people who you see them that they have this strong sense of, they turn to be people who work really well with blissful states. Hmm. Like you say, this is what you were missing all along, and you will never know unless you give it a try. So I think keeping this openness to give it a try, as you were discussing on trying, on picking things and following your intuition. But ultimately, I think there's an underlying source of all these behaviors. And it comes to my mind, Papaji, when he was describing how instead of you shouldn't have desires. No, he said, no, you have to have a fun desire. You know, I love that. That's like samatha. It's like desires are not bad, are only bad because you're confused. We only have one desire, just one. If we get to realize that simplicity, then suddenly all your behavior and everything feels like the most natural thing. This leads back into when we were discussing about discipline with meditation and sati as remembering, mindfulness as remembering. Because for me, there shouldn't be any of yourself of forcing. And yes, sometimes people may drop meditation for a while just to come stronger when they realize that, oh yeah, I'm looking for that. I'm looking for experiencing myself, for a deeper connection with myself, with this moment and with everything. And that's a moment they may start meditating or may find a new way of meditating. Who knows, you know, in the sense that they find maybe there are special people who, I don't know, I'm just thinking about people now with AI or with social media, there are new generations coming and finding new ways of connecting and using all this technology for the ultimate longing desire that we have. And I think when you do that, then you don't care about eating chocolate or drinking alcohol or pleasing yourself in any way. It doesn't matter because you are doing exactly what you want in every moment. And that thing that you want, it may be in the beginning a bit abstract. That's where people go, you go into prayers or you go into certain kind of things. Of course, there are different levels of prayers. I understand that, but I'm talking in the regular way. We go into these routines until you find that, until you had this moment of, and then you know, yeah, this is it. And this thing wasn't caused by anything. The reason why meditation brings this up is because you didn't do anything. That's what is a causeless bliss. That's what is you're getting closer to this release of pain and suffering and just resting in this state of recognition of something that is there, let's say. And in that resting, you find everything you want, which is the most ironic thing, because you find everything you want by letting go of everything you want, apparently, as a person. You find the only thing you want. And the moment that hopefully people get to contact that, I think there's a moment where they won't stop meditating for the rest of their life.
Did Shinzen ever tell you about that thing he was doing with Jeffrey Martin, where they had some kind of device that was directing a very precise beam of magnetism to a certain part of the brain? Jeffrey told me that Shinzen said he was having better experiences with that than he'd ever had with all of his Zen practice.
Yeah, we never went into that. He didn't come.
You reminded me of it when you were talking about finding some new way of meditation, and we've been talking about science and all that kind of stuff. So interesting. I don't know what they're doing with that now or what the long-term effects of that might be, but
they're still researching on that.
Yeah, I guess they were hoping that there could be something which would shortcut the whole process of awakening, you know, using some kind of device.
But he also mentioned something like, I think it's in his book, he says something like, yeah, I'm talking about this way of not hacking, but supporting. But yeah, he's not saying, I'm not so deluded to think that that's going to get you to enlightenment. He made some statement in the book about that, I think.
But there could be things which would be like catalysts. they'd be conducive to
yeah.
speeding things up, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, some people think psychedelics will do that, and sometimes I think they do, but they could also be problematics.
Yeah,
with
I think most people,
stuff,
I mean,
to be careful.
You may tell me, you probably have talked to everyone about this, but in my experience and everyone I know, and again, I'm thinking about Ram Dass because I hear people stop, when they go at a certain level, they stop doing that, right?
They what?
They start using psychedelics in order to reach that state. That certainly psychedelics, I mean, I did have some big experiences with it, but I just dropped it because honestly, I was a kid. I went crazy. I thought that I went crazy. I was seriously worried. I went to go into psychologists. I went to nuns and monks. I went everywhere like trying to find, and people were worried about me. But because suddenly from one single experience, my mind stopped. Like it stopped radically, completely. Mm-hmm. Like I was immersed into, I don't know how to describe it. Of course, the experience was, but what I'm saying is it was a very meaningful experience. And yet it was just, for some of us, seems to, you have these glimpses you could have with psychedelics or with anything. You can make it trances in so many ways. And some people don't need trances. They just take one step at a time. But in my case, I have to confess that for me was instrumental in my process to have that pack. And it kind of created an opening. And after that, I think it's like it will happen with regular drugs. You are using an external element to create something. So you're getting a temporary pass, let's say. So that can be very powerful in the sense of showing you what is in there for you to experience if you were a bit more open-minded. But in the end of the day, you're paying the price of losing normality, of the health of your body, of course, and different ways. Mm-hmm. So at some point, I had one teacher, one non-dual teacher, Cesar, from Advaita Vedanta. He's from Colombia, very nice guy. And he told me, don't you ever do that again. He said, you're too sensitive to that. You're going to screw yourself if you do that again. And I say, okay, I really believe him. And now, you know, like 20 years later, I think, yeah, he was absolutely right. And so people approach me now because, as you know, there's these psychedelic trends. And I think it's valuable. And I hear some of the people that I'm working with, and it deepens their meditation, but then we are meeting again the situation that, yeah, but you still need to deal with your life. So, okay, it's really cool that you get some extra boost of nitro, like, and you can get a bit farther than you would do otherwise. But is that really freedom when you need something?
Some people think they can damage the subtle body. And even though you have some profound experience, it can take a long time to repair that. And so it's not a long time term strategy. And as Alan Watts put it, when you get the message, hang up the phone. You don't need to. There's some good research with it and it's helping a lot of people, you know, alcoholics and various people. It's not a long term strategy. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people are using it as such and doing it over and over and over again. And I don't think the outcome of that is going to be good. But anyway, we're getting sort of towards the end of our time, and I'm wondering if there's anything that, when we've covered a lot of ground, but is there anything that you feel is important that we haven't touched upon?
Not really.
Okay. Well, we did cover a lot. So tell us, like, you know, you live in Germany, but you probably talk to people all over the world, and you have a kind of a coaching thing which people can see on your website, which I will link to on your page on BatGap. Is there anything you want to say about that?
Yeah. I started with that because I felt more comfortable. I feel more comfortable in one-to-one, actually. Mm-hmm. But I realized that there's a strong limitations with that because I don't want to stop being a musician just to get into this new business of So I have a limited time for that. I realized, okay, in this way I cannot really serve people. So okay, I have to up my game, and so I start going on YouTube and things like that. But most importantly, I started I created this community, and I'm trying to put in the resources. So I say this because just it's not about the money, it's not about that. And actually I'm trying to kind of detach these things and create an environment. What I notice is very powerful, and I hope if anyone is meditating alone and hear this and all that, of course I'm offering this space for people to interact and to talk, and you know, I think that's that can be very nice. That's a project that I'm building. And of course I have some courses in there to do, and everything of course is free and so on. Well, I have some little groups that we're working together. It's a different business, but I just want to throw in there a lot of content and a lot of tools for people to freely access and interact with other people in the same path. So that's a project.
One final question is there a YouTube channel or something for your band? I'd like to watch some videos of your band playing.
It's not a band. It's a solo project.
Oh, solo. Anyway, send me some info about your music too.
I will. I'd like to watch it. Thank you. But only if you send me some stuff of you playing drums.
Okay. I have an old video and some photos, and the video doesn't even have audio. It was filmed with a Super 8 camera back in 1970. So anyway, or 69 maybe.
You're wearing long hair or something?
Oh yes, long hair. And we almost went to Woodstock, but we didn't leave on time, and it wasn't possible to get anywhere near the place if you didn't leave early, you know, because the New York State Thruway was a parking lot.
Almost famous.
Alrighty. Good. Well, thanks. Really enjoyed talking to you. We'll be in touch.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you for everyone.
Yeah, and thanks to those who've been listening or watching, and we'll see you for the next one.